A big week for the precious metals following the much-anticipated FOMC rate decision. Hello, everyone. Chris Waltzek. It's great to be back with you this weekend. We have another infotainment-packed episode with three big guest interviews. Well, volatility continues to increase, a roller coaster ride in the markets following that big rate decision where the FOMC held rates steady. Joining me with his perspective on the topic, hailing from the Big Apple, New York, adventure capitalist Jim Rogers says, eventually market forces will overcome monetary policies. He's bullish, especially on the yellow metal in the long-term horizon. Eventually, gold will enter bubble territory. Not to worry, he says. For now, cash is king. He thinks the greenback could ascend for the time being, which could culminate in bubble conditions and be the perfect opportunity to switch back into the precious metals. Then, from humble beginnings in the 1600s at Lloyd's of London coffee shop on Lombard Street, the insurance industry is essential for the modern way of life. Millions of people sleep soundly at night just knowing that their families, homes, autos, businesses are secure against unforeseen events and economic disaster. So it's a pleasure to welcome in his debut appearance, Chief Actuary Vince Bodner of LTCG Long-Term Care. He makes his debut on the show, outlining how actuaries quantify peace of mind, minimize overall expenses, and maximize the benefits to the policyholder, society, and shareholders. Chief Bodner encourages all mathematically inclined listeners to learn more about the actuarial sciences as a profession. Then Bob Hoy brings all the runners across home plate, senior investment strategist at Institutional Advisors. He's watching the precious metals for a rebound, but suggests keeping powder dry for bigger opportunities. Then Robert Ian joins the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week amid renewed rate hike expectations. Investors sought refuge in the yellow metal as volatility in the global equities and currency markets escalated. Gold added $31, finishing at $11.40 an ounce. Silver added 56 cents, up 4%, finishing at $15.15 an ounce. And the XEU Gold and Silver Equities Index stole the show, gaining 8% in a week, finishing just shy of 49. West Texas Intermediate crude also gained half a dollar, 1%, finishing at $45 per barrel. Well, the top story moving the commodities markets this week was the big rate decision announcement on Thursday, September 17th. Gold leaped higher on news that the Fed would hold rates steady at 0 to 0.25% on Thursday. Investors will now be watching for comments from policymakers and Fed heads ahead of the rate hike scheduled in about 6 weeks. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, as noted last week, the XAU remains strong, blasting higher along with gold and silver this week. Clearly, without the immediate threat of an FOMC rate hike, gold stocks caught the sellers off guard. Signs of accumulation are beginning to appear in the charts. That's a positive. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies were seen over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors lightened their portfolios of equities following news on Thursday that the Fed held rates steady. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped 49 points, finishing near break-even at 16,384. The S&P 500 finished at 1958, off about 3 points, about 2%, while the Nasdaq actually finished in the plus column, adding 5 points, finishing at 48.27. Comments following the FOMC rate announcement indicated concern by some Fed governors that slow growth outside the U.S. could curtail international demand for U.S. goods and services. In addition, by holding rates steady, the Fed signaled to investors that domestic economic conditions might not be as robust as reported. There are two more Fed meetings scheduled for this year, one in October and again in December. Bottom line on Wall Street, fear remains elevated in the seven-component sentiment index as well as the VIX index, and a personal favorite leading index, the VVIX, which is the first derivative of the VIX index, or just a measure of volatility of the volatility. You might think of it as a gauge of the rate of change of investor fear. Well, the indexes suggest that next week could be the beginning of an unpleasant time for equities traders, so caution somewhat advisable here. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek Radio 3 top guests, and then Robert Ian wrapping up the show. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you and with our listeners.
Yes, it's great to have you back, and wow, what an exciting day. The Federal Reserve did exactly as expected. They didn't pull the trigger on rates, and I say exactly what's expected. Should qualify that by making it clear they'd been promising us they were going to raise rates. They didn't, but the 30-day Fed funds futures had already deciphered their rhetoric and said, no, there's a 77-ish percent odds that they're not going to do anything on Thursday. Tell us what's going on here.
You know me, I think that the Federal Reserve System and the economists involved in it really don't know what they're doing. The problem is that they've learned certain theories about financial markets, and they never stop to think about them. So this business about setting interest rates and discussing policy and hints about this and that, they don't know what they're doing. And also, the street shouldn't be following them. Mainly because as we went back and noted that when the senior central bank, and it used to be the Bank of England, was able to freely change interest rates, administered rates, and that in the first bubble they had that freedom was the 1873 bubble. So then you had the other big booms and whatnot after that, and then the 1929 bubble. Then 2007, and then you had that bubble. So anyways, what you have going on is that the moves by the senior central bank on interest rate changes at key points in very big markets are 2 to 3 months behind what's going on in market rates of interest. So they are a follower, not a setter of rates. Well, the other thing I think on this one, you stop and you say, okay, well, when was the last time that the U.S. had zero interest rates for administered rates and zero on treasury bills? Well, it was the 1930s. Let's look at the conditions back then. Major contraction, the Federal Reserve pumping like mad, easy as can be, and you were not on a gold standard, so it wasn't fully in the hands of the market to allocate credit. They were the meddlers were still somewhat influential, but nevertheless, the rates went to virtually zero. And I think the only explanation for that was that there was so much ease around and so much fear that the serious money bought treasury bills, driving rates down. So here we have now, and as we always write, that in times of concern, the real money, the serious money, goes to the most liquid items. It's the item you can get in and out of. The most liquid items are gold and treasury bills in the U.S. dollar. So here we are. I don't think that they can deliberately raise rates. Yeah,
this is interesting. Spoke with Jim Rogers last night. This is probably not what's going to happen, but it's exactly what I'm doing here. I'm staying long dollars and going more long dollars because I believe they're going to spike up, and that's going to be the perfect opportunity to sell out and go all in on gold.
Yep. Here's the other thing about the Federal Reserve. Where their essential blunder lies is they assume there is a national economy. They have to assume a national economy because that's what they think they're managing. But never in history have you had a national economy because they're always trade. Even back in Roman times, Cicero pointed out that if they had a financial problem in the Asian provinces, meaning the Middle East, and there was a mortgage collapse, then bang, it would eventually work its way into Rome. So this business is that's an essential blunder that backs up policymaking. Now, the next blunder is one logic. They took a look at the business cycle, and they saw that credit expanded as business expanded. What would you expect? But then they get into cause. So they assume then that if you then push credit out the window, it would force a business expansion. But, you know, in logic, that's called a primitive syllogism. The other famous one is that when roosters crow in the morning, they cause the sun to rise. That are absolutely unsupportable are the major behind interventionist economics. One, the assumption of a national economy. Two, a primitive syllogism, that two things, they confuse correlation with causation. So completely wrong from the start. There's been, if you go all the way back to 1618 to 1623, when a reasonable writer at the time in England, Edward Mitheldon, wrote a piece, and then within it,
I think you've made such an important point, and I want the listeners to really grasp the fullness of this. When you talk about a primitive syllogism, you're obviously very well read and knowledgeable. I just happen to know exactly what you mean because I study logic in the evenings in preparation for the actuarial exams. But not everyone's going to know, and I didn't even know up until the last 12 months or so what a syllogism is. It's so key to understanding what you're getting at. You're pointing out that this concept that our policymakers adhere to, these concepts that we can simplify down to a cause and effect relationship, but there's a problem there. The problem is a syllogism, which is just a proof, if you will, or a deduction based on two things that we see occurring and then drawing a conclusion. But they're forgetting that it is a complex system. Here, let me give an example. We see a red sky. It is nighttime. More than likely, the weather will be fair in the morning. Okay, this has been known for thousands of years. That is a basic conclusion. That's a syllogism, but that's not a complex. Well, it really is if you want to talk about weather. But the point is, it's not a truly complex system. Now, here's a complex system. An economy is based on 300 million people, their opinions, their beliefs, and more importantly, their behaviors. That's complex, my friend. They are drawing false conclusions based on premises that do not hold, people. You can't say A plus B equals C when you're working with a complex system.
The foundation behind interventionist economics has been absurd and dangerous all the way along. And what's more, it never works. Now, if you take, for example, the guys who are pushing the Fed, the formation of the Fed in 1907, 1910, in there, their boast was, well, what they saw that concerned them is that you'd have a roaring stock market, gets overbought, comes down, and you got pressures in the credit markets, then you get a recession. That's the way history of business has worked for hundreds of years. But these guys get in there and they say, oh, if we can prevent the harsh recession, you know, the bust, then the economy will keep going. So then part of the reasoning behind the Fed was that they would prevent setbacks in the financial markets. That would prevent recessions. There's been 19 recessions since 1914 when they opened the doors. Also, there's been some crazy booms and busts. You've had the 29 boom and bust. You had the 2007 boom and bust, which was remarkably similar. And now you're on the first business expansion out of a major crash, and this now is mature. The Chinese market blew out in June. And earlier in the year, we looked at financial history, and it was April when the China market really started to launch. And so in history, most great bubbles, going back to the South Sea Bubble, peaked in May or June. South Sea Bubble actually in June. And here we had the peak in Shanghai on June the 15th. Now, what also was needed with that, Chris, was that we needed some technical stuff, and the launch included on our proprietary model upside exhaustion readings, but we needed three clusters of those. And the third cluster came in June, but it was only one. It wasn't a cluster, but it was enough to end the market. So you had the crash, the hard hit, and then you've had in September, then we expected there would be a recovery here. So the worst of the crash was August 24th. They called it Black Monday. And at that point, commodities and stocks, junk bonds were very depressed, and credit spreads had widened. So we figured, okay, maybe 2 weeks of relief in the credit spreads, maybe 4 weeks. So we're now into the second week of relief in credit spreads, and they went a little further today. But whenever they have these Fed meetings, there's so many people in the game who have been trained to follow the Fed that they can't help but have an influence for a day or two, and that's what they had now. Now, so what we're now looking for is credit spreads, perhaps next week, would start to widen. And that was what prompted recent troubles in the market. We used this in 1998 when the disaster was discovered to be long-term capital management, highly leveraged, huge fund. And there was, when you've had a roaring credit market, you can get a seasonal change in May or June where it turns to widening. And that's what happened that May, June. And then in July is when the spread started to break out, and then such that you then had long-term capital market on the wrong side of the trade, highly leveraged, and they got liquidated. So there was a huge crash all the way down to October. I remember Citigroup, I was short the stock. It fell 40% August to October. It was really very exciting. So then you move ahead to 2007. We were doing the same thing. Credit markets were very, very popular. Spreads were narrowing. And again, the same seasonal came in. And in May, credit spreads stopped narrowing and start to widen. And then in July, they did the two breakouts to new highs for widening. And that then set up the market here. Now, what happened then is that the S&P made a high in that October of 2007, which is unusual to find a high there. But what prompted the sell-off after that was that you went through in that September 2007, the pause in credit spread widening. And the moment it started to widen, that's when the high was for the stock market. So here we are now. Oh, sorry, one more. In 2008, same thing. The stock market had sold off down into January, rallied out to about May or something like that. Then that May, the spread narrowing turned to widening. And in July broke out. By this time, the market was heading south pretty good. So this is what we've been following for this year, that we were in party mode. So we would watch for credit spreads to narrow into May. They did. Turn to widening. And then in July, do the critical breakout. Our July 23rd edition said that the bull market for stocks was over. And then the credit spreads widened, and then one by one, various exchanges headed south. So then, as I said, the pressures in the spread market got maxed out on August 24th, and they've now been looking for, in September, 2, maybe 3 weeks of relief in the spread market. And then the next turn to widening will take this stock market down rather sharply. Now, if you didn't know anything about this financial history and the way it works with the credit spreads, you could just straight look at the charts. And you know that on the S&P, for example, that low in August low need to be tested. You could say the same thing about the Chinese market. That low needs to be tested. So we're going to go down into October. Then it gets the critical part. What will happen at the last lows test? Will it go through? Or will it bounce? And my guess is that, hey, there's a whole lot of garbage hanging over the market. There's a whole lot of very reckless positions, and it'll be resolved on the downside. So,
since you obviously are bearish somewhat on the sector, and you certainly have been right thus far, I've only been bearish in retrospect. Each week I go through, for my Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers, I comb through my favorite list of about 100 companies, whittle it down to the ones that are technically looking strong. In these solid bellwether companies, I'm finding every third or fourth candidate a diamond pattern. A seasoned veteran like yourself knows that's the kiss of death for any stock, any company, any futures contract, any options, any index, any bourse. And the diamond is not something you want to see if you're bullish.
Well, we look at a number of other things. For example, said on the Shanghai Exchange, it had to do another cluster of upside exhaustion. So that's a proprietary model on that one, and it did do that. Now, we're not finding anything yet. Now, the other handle on this proprietary model that gets upside exhaustions at the highs, it also tries to get what we call downside capitulations. Now, on a falling market, and there's still many bulls around in the early stages of a falling market, and they kind of like to buy the dips. But sometimes that turns out to be like trying to buy, as the saying goes, catch a falling knife. The model, we're nowhere near getting buys there, so we'll advise on those. But what I think impressed us here is that when you took out various important moving averages, and also the seasonality. So, yeah, it's been a heads-up August, sort of trying to stabilize September. But we always know that if anything wrong or anything bad is going to be discovered, it'll usually be discovered in October. So this is another thing you're getting here, is that it's been quite a surprise to the commodity bulls that you would have such consistent weakness in commodities when you had such reckless central bank behavior. And this then is gets into another one of these elusive concepts, Chris, because in the 1970s, the Federal Reserve ease or ambition was associated with soaring commodity prices, soaring wholesale prices, soaring wages, whole lots of things. So this is where then you had a lot of the gold bugs formed, and they then pitch became the Fed is evil, it's going to depreciate forever, and gold's going to go to 10,000. But what you were in was in a period of time when the public chose to speculate in hard assets, and the Fed went along with the game. So in 1980, 81, this huge boom in commodities blew out. Volcker happened to be chairman of Fed at the time. But the blowout in commodities was very similar to the huge one in 1920 when Volcker was not chairman of the Fed and you had a crash in commodities that was horrendous. So then the Fed in the 1920s policy was easy money because they were very afraid that commodities would fall further. But they didn't notice that their ease was then changed, and it went into stocks, financial assets. So that's the simple, the model we used in 81, 82, when I was first presenting research to financial institutions, and the overall conclusion was that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks will outperform commodities. Well, at that stage, fund managers, many of them, were just discovering that inflation was caused by the Fed. And they could not accept that you're going to go into a period where the Fed would keep expanding credit money supply, but stocks would go up, not commodities. And that, of course, was the case. And, of course, you then had the commodity bulls. They spent 18 years watching that bear market in commodities, and then when they finally bottomed 2004 or something, they then said because there was an 18-year bear market, there would be an 18-year bull market for commodities. Well, they peaked good high in 2007, another high in 2008. That one was with crude oil, and that was the story about peak crude oil. Well, let me tell you about how we worked that one, which we told you about, the model upside exhaustion. So at the end of June into early July, we were getting upside exhaustions on the weekly. So as I wrote it, that this signal now is saying that there could be a cyclical bear market for crude oil, and noted that if it was still up by the end of the month and registered a monthly upside exhaustion, it would be a secular bear market for crude oil. Now, in July 19, 2008, that was a good call. Also, at the time, we were doing base metals and took the real price deflated by the producer price index. And we had 100 years of data on that one, and it was the, oh, it was maybe double or 2.5 times the previous price increase going into 1920 or any other time, or 74. So it was a huge increase in the real price of base metals. Then it stayed up there from 2007, 2008. There were peaks there, but it stayed up. And then 2011 was the ultimate high, or the last high. So what that did is it prompted base metal mining companies to put on a lot of capacity. So this is why. And then we also in 2011, our upside exhaustion thing gave another huge signal on commodities in general, so that there'd be a considerable bear market to follow, so which is what we're in. So that then identified the 2008 peak, because it had commodities and it had real estate, and it was had many similarities with the 1929 high. So here's where we count this off now, Chris, is that you had the crash to 2009. You've had a business expansion and a huge credit expansion and a bubble in financial assets since. This now is mature, and as China is showing, which was the main source of boom stuff around the world, it's failing. The U.S. economy is not seen to be failing, but like the industrial production number is down. The one that we saw this week, most impressive, was auto assembly numbers, which spiked up in July. And the August month was a way down. It's the sharpest one since 2007. I think that was the July one. Anyways, in 2007, the final number was a spike up. Then the next month, way down. So this is a serious drop in U.S. auto assemblies, and it follows, although it's a slightly different series, in China, their automobile sales peaked in April, and there's May, June. There's three consecutive months of sharp declines in China's auto sales. So they're slight for numbers, but hey, one led the other. And so the outlook for commodities continues to be bleak. We don't see them as exceptionally oversold. We don't see them into our downside capitulation model yet. And that then gets us out to the precious metals. And we've had a little rally in the precious metals this week, but I think it's tied to the fact that we're looking for a seasonal rally for crude oil and copper into the middle of September. Also, wheat can be a bit firm seasonally at this time of year. But on these one by one, crude oil would, as the next seasonal low would be, say, down in December, maybe into January. For copper, the next seasonal low is late November, and wheat, as if I recall rightly, you get seasonal lows in November and December. So these commodities about to head south, and they could take the recent rally in gold. We're looking for something like between 1145 and 1185 on the gold price, but it's not an extended rally. There's just not enough other technical things to think that it would extend. On the gold shares, we would look for stability, for a bottom in here. It would need stability in the relative price between gold shares and the price of bullion itself. And I just checked that recently here with the Huey divided by gold. No, it's down, but it ain't stabilizing yet. So we would not be committing money to buying the gold shares yet. And then the problem is with silver, when you're into precarious credit markets, I've taken to calling the gold-silver ratio the metallic credit spread, because in good times, the gold-silver ratio goes down, like it narrows, and in contractionary times, it widens and goes further out. So gold-silver ratio, if it gets above 77, 78 again, that would be a breakout. And that would be indicating further pressures in the credit market. So, hey, it's September. We're looking for seasonal problems. If they come out, they're going to come out in October. And we're looking at the charts for the stock market, for junk bonds, for most commodities and precious metals, not so strong. The opportunities are not there yet.
Bob, I think you've covered the gamut there. It sounds very good. I was going to ask you what you thought about the precious metals, but I think you've made it clear. Keep our powder dry for now. Please tell people more about the institutionaladvisor.com, the services that you provide, and why everyone's going to want to bookmark that website and find out more.
Institutionaladvisors.com, or it's easier if you just Google my name for some reason or other, Bob Hoy, H-O-Y-E, it all comes up. And we publish regularly on Thursdays our pivotal events, which covers what we've been talking about. Then the technical research we put out under the heading of Chartworks, and it's published on Opportunity. So it just came out with one today on gold. So get into the website, take a look, get in touch with Brian Ripley, who looks after our website, and put you on for a free subscription and let it go for about 4 weeks.
Bob Hoy, institutionaladvisors.com. What a wealth of knowledge. Please return to goldseek.com radio with your next set of insights.
There we are, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Jim Rogers, financial author and commentator, hedge fund manager, co-founder of Quantum Fund and International Commodities Index in 1998. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show today. Welcome back, Jim Rogers.
I'm delighted to be back, Chris.
You're probably watching for the rate decision. That'll be announced on September 17th, this Thursday, around 2:15. Looking at the implied probabilities at the Fed Funds Futures contract, there's about a 74% chance this morning the Fed will hold rates steady at that 0.25%. Only about a 26% chance of a rate hike. Are you expecting a curveball on Thursday?
Well, I suspect they will raise rates, Chris, but, you know, I don't really pay so much attention to it. It's astonishing to me, back here in the U.S., how much attention is paid to this. But whatever happens is going to happen. The market has probably discounted it. Either way, if rates go up, fine, they're out of the way. If it doesn't go up, then we're all going to be worried about when they're going to go up. So they may not do it. I suspect they will do something on Thursday. But if not, I'm sure they'll do something in October or November to surprise us and make us think that they're all, you know, real he-men, which they're not.
Right. So more than likely nothing this week then, and then they probably do have to pull the trigger later on. Did I understand that correctly?
I suspect they will do something on Thursday to get it out of the way to surprise us. And if they don't, they'll do something in October or November to surprise us, because, you know, they have meetings every 3 months. But they can do something anytime they want to. There's nothing written in stone that they have to do it at regular meetings every 3 months.
That would shock the markets, you know, throw the markets into turmoil. I suspect you'd probably see a huge spike in volatility if they do actually raise a quarter point to half a point on their benchmark overnight lending rate.
Yeah, whatever it is, it'll be temporary. We all know interest rates are going to go higher somewhere down the road. And so, yeah, maybe it will throw the markets into confusion for a day or two, but or even a week, which I can't imagine, but we know what's going to happen.
Well, moving on to the next question, you know, investor fear has certainly increased. It's one of the highest levels we've seen since the dot-com bubble peak. That can lead to downtrends. You know, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller is saying that he sees another bubble in equities. Of course, he's been calling a bubble for several years. Do you share his sentiments that investors could be surprised with more downside in their favorite stocks?
We're certainly going to have more downside. Well, first, let me address the bubble question. We don't have a bubble in the U.S. We have an overpriced or a high-priced stock market. But it may be a bubble in some sectors like biotechnology or something. But no, we don't have an overall bubble. We have an expensive and overpriced stock market, but that's different from a bubble. There may be a bubble in some places, but not in the U.S., not yet. Can prices go down? Yes, and they probably will go down a lot sometime in the next year or two. Yes, it's been over 6 years since this has been going up. The market's had virtually no corrections or serious corrections in 6 years. And that's unusual. So, no, we're going to have a huge problem when we have a problem. We've had problems, economic problems, every 4 to 7 years since the beginning of the Republic. We're going to continue to have them, and the next one's going to be worse because the debt is so much higher.
You know, it's interesting you should say that because, you know, in the past, before the Fed, if you will, there was a lot of volatility in the markets, but it was as though the forest fire cleared all the underbrush and then the forest came back, or the stock market and the economy came roaring back, and it was a healthy, vibrant economy for another decade or so. Now that we keep putting off and postponing and postponing and postponing the day of reckoning, you know, it really makes one wonder if an end game could play out here. And the current Fed head, the current chair of the Fed, doesn't have the same, I think, background that the former Fed Bernanke had. This current Fed head just is less focused on the Great Depression and the deflationary aspects, which makes me think that higher rates, they're not just threatening. I mean, this really could happen, and it could put a damper on the real estate market, the overall economy, and almost every sector. Do you expect gold to become a safe haven under that scenario?
But I want to go back to a couple of things. Ben Bernanke didn't understand anything either. Neither one of these guys, Yellen or Bernanke, and for that matter, Greenspan didn't really know what he was doing either. The days when we had people like William McChesney Martin or Paul Volcker, who understood markets and understood economics and finance, those days are gone, I'm afraid. We now have academics who don't have a clue about what's going on. Can interest rates, and what I'm afraid is going to happen is that the market's going to take control at some point here, and the central banks are not going to be able to control the market because the market has more money than the central banks, no matter how hard they try. And at that point, interest rates will go much higher than most people expect, and it's going to surprise a lot of people. You know, it was only 30 years ago that interest rates were over 20% in the U.S., so that's not so long ago historically, and average rates are certainly much higher than 0.25%, which is what we have now. As far as gold, I certainly expect gold to have its day again. I'm not buying gold at the moment and haven't for a while, as you know, but if it goes lower, I hope I'm smart enough to buy a lot more, because gold is going to wind up in a bubble before it's over. Don't worry, Chris, it'll be a bubble someday.
I'm going to take you at your word. And looking at the U.S. dollar index, obviously the precious metals are highly impacted. There's a strong correlation, negative correlation there. The U.S. dollar was in a super steep rally, let's call it, for 9 months, and it's been consolidating for another 4 or 5 months, looking very weak recently, as though maybe that uptrend could be in jeopardy. That would seem to bode well for the precious metals. Any comments?
Historically, yes. There have been many times when they've gone in separate directions. I'm still long the dollar. I expect the dollar to go higher because my view is in the next turmoil, people are going to flee for a safe haven. They will see the U.S. dollar as a safe haven first, not the yen, not the euro, or something like that.
and the dollar will probably go too high. It'll get overpriced, maybe even turn into a bubble, at which point, in my scenario, gold would be lower, at which point I would swap my dollars for gold and make a great trade. It probably won't happen that way since that's my scenario, but I would think dollars will go up, gold will go down, at which point I will switch from dollars to gold. And at that point, we start seeing gold really turn into a huge bull market again. That's how I'm playing.
You mentioned black gold. You know, West Texas Intermediate crude certainly has suffered over the past 6 months. And at some point, there just has to be a tradable nadir there. Are you watching the market carefully for a bottom?
Yes, I suspect we are making a bottom now. It may be a complicated bottom, or if we suddenly have some kind of shock to the world, gold could go. Oil could certainly go down below its old lows. But it seems to me that we are testing the bottom, the earlier bottom. You know, we had the big collapse, we had the dead cat bounce, and now we're having the test of the bottom. I suspect we are making the bottom now. Maybe a little complicated, but the fundamentals, Chris, are still getting better. The world has consumed more than it has produced in the last several years, except for fracking, and fracking can't make any money at these prices. Some of them are starting to go bankrupt, and the rest of the world reserves are declining. Fracking doesn't seem to work very well in the rest of the world. So, no, we're probably making a low now, at the bottom now.
I agree with you. Moving on to the XAU, you know, you've already given us your thoughts on the precious metals, but this is another battered sector that was high-flying for many years. You know, we're seeing some top-quality companies 60, 70, 80% or more off of their bull market highs. Are you stalking these markets at all for opportunities and discounts?
Not in the U.S. We talked before about the U.S. market. The U.S. market is an overpriced and expensive market, so I'm really not looking for things to buy here. And if I decide to buy energy, I would probably just buy oil futures themselves, because that's a nice way to make money if you get it right. Or I might try to buy outside the U.S. But I'm leery of the U.S. market at the moment.
Are you also of the XAU in gold and precious metals equities?
Same. I'd rather buy gold. I own gold, as you know. I hedge some of my gold, but I'm still long gold, and I'd rather buy gold itself than the gold stocks. If you get the gold stocks right, Chris, you make much, much, much more, as you know, because a gold stock can go up 20 or 30 or 40 times, just like an oil stock can. And gold is not going to go up 20 or 30 or 40 times, nor is oil. So if you get it right, you'll make more in the stocks, but also that's a lot more work.
As we wrap up here today, I wanted to ask you your sentiments on the Middle East and whether or not you see a potential flare-up in tensions there.
Oh, there's always a potential for flares in the Middle East. My goodness, there's not just, you know, two parties in the Middle East. There are a dozen parties in the Middle East, and every one of them seems to be making a mistake. I don't see anybody doing things right in the Middle East, whether it's Israelis or us or the Syrians, whoever. You pick the party. We're all making mistakes, so it's very likely that the next major war will start in the Middle East just because it's such a flashpoint. And that, of course, will drive oil much higher, probably drive gold much higher, you know, all commodities.
And as we wrap up today, you always seem to have some market that the mainline media hasn't quite picked up on yet that you're watching closely. Anything come to mind?
I try to buy China when it collapses. If we have really big, big drops, I try to buy a few shares there. I bought shares, a few shares of Zimbabwe recently and a few shares of Ghana recently, very few, but both of them are disasters, absolute unmitigated disasters, and I think I see positive changes taking place, so I'm starting to buy those two. But other than that, I don't really have anything new and exciting or different, although I guess some people would say Zimbabwe and Ghana are new and different.
If I can just recap, maybe lighten up a bit in their portfolios on U.S. equities and probably bonds, too, for that matter. Cash might be king for a while.
Absolutely. And U.S. dollar cash. When you're in cash, you have to make sure you're in the right currency. Because if you're in the wrong currency, you could get wiped out. In my view right now, U.S. dollars, the cash.
Jim Rogers, thanks for your time today. And please enjoy your visit and travels in New York.
Thank you very much, Chris. Let's do it again sometime.
Here is
is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, the actuarial sciences have regularly appeared as the world's leading profession for 30 years, but few people outside the industry understand the subtle nuances. So it's a pleasure to welcome Vince Bodner today, Chief Actuary, named as one of the world's most creative minds in the insurance profession. Welcome, Vince Bodner.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that very nice welcome.
Since its humble beginnings on Lombard Street with Lloyd's of London, the insurance industry has really morphed into this multi-trillion dollar business model. It's come quite a long way. Now billions of people worldwide can rest easier at night knowing their homes, autos, and their loved ones have economic protection. Now actuaries help to quantify the price of that peace of mind to the overall benefit of shareholders, policyholders, and to society as a whole. If you could please give us an overview of the actuarial profession. Maybe we could start off there and feel free to add any issues and nuances. This is a commercial-free program, so you can run with the ball.
You've captured the basics pretty well. Actuaries, we are mathematicians at heart. We study and we're also very adept at understanding probability and statistics. And so what we do for insurance companies is determine, you know, for a given risk pool, how much in aggregate the people in that risk pool will incur in claims. So, you know, for example, if you've got a pool of, just say, 10,000 people, we will study statistics about mortality and determine, based on the characteristics of that pool, how many people in that pool may die over the next year, for example, just to pick a morbid subject. Of course, not everybody will, but for those who do, that's a tragedy. And so the other people who have contributed funds into that pool, they'll put it in for the benefit of receiving a payment if they run into that tragic event. And so, you know, actuaries need to understand what drives the probabilities for a given event. So again, that's very statistical. We look at historical data, understand not only what the probability might be for an aggregate pool, but for, you know, individuals as well. So we will look at various characteristics. Like, for example, you know, females have lower mortality rates than males, so we need to understand that. Older people die more frequently than younger people. So we need to take all these different mixes and predictors, we call them, and factor those in.
While preparing for the exam P, you know, I couldn't help but notice that the Bayesian analysis is, I think, integral to many areas within the field. For instance, just to give our listeners a basic overview, it's sort of an interesting probability or examination of the world in reverse. So let's say that we know that A has occurred, maybe a car accident has occurred. We'd like to know what is the probability that it was either one, two, or three models of the car or ages of the individual. What is the likelihood of that probability stream? It's sort of counterintuitive, but it's a remarkable, you might call it an induction method, a posteriori.
So what actuaries will look for is our predictors. And these are things that tell us what characteristics really drive the incidence of an event up or down. And again, I gave a few examples of that with respect to mortality. We know that females have lower mortality rates than males. Older people have higher mortality rates than younger people. That's very simplistic, but there's a whole area of actuarial science that will dive down and look at other correlations. For example, a good example of this would be in the property casualty industry, specifically the auto insurance industry, where actuaries are constantly studying the different characteristics of people who get in accidents versus those who don't. And some things pop out of that analysis when we look at, you know, lots of data about these people. For example, people with higher credit scores have accidents a lot less frequently than people with lower credit scores. That is now a rating factor. Once the property casualty industry discovered that predictor several years ago, that became a rating factor. And many people in your audience probably are now familiar with this. They may get a letter in the mail from their auto insurance company saying, I'm sorry, your premium rates are going up because your credit score went down. And someone will think, well, I haven't had an accident. Why is this happening? And it's because of this predictor, this thing, something about you changed that is factored into this actuarial analysis. And that's just one example, but actuaries are constantly looking for these in, you know, all fields, the auto industry, health insurance. The health insurance industry is now looking at these very carefully, and then that is making its way into, you know, many other fields as well. And they call that predictive modeling is the specific term for that.
You mentioned at the beginning that actuaries really are at heart mathematicians. Folks really recognize the significance of the applied mathematics there. And that leads me to another question I have for you. It's interesting as we read through the literature how many tests that are given, such as mammograms, oftentimes come up with false positives. Some of the research here is, I think, astounding that just because one receives a positive test there, meaning that there could be the need to see an ontologist, that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a high statistical probability that one has the disease. And it really is the conditional probability behind that according to several articles, recent articles, last 5 years or less, timely peer-reviewed articles, that seems to indicate that even some of our best physicians haven't been given the proper mathematical training to understand the results that they receive, which could lead to numerous unnecessary procedures. Chief Bodner, I wonder if perhaps you'd like to discuss the areas that you find most interesting, let's say over the next 5 to 10 years in your field.
Sure. I see a lot of change particularly in longevity. So people are living longer. That's a phenomenon that we have been recording as an actuarial field for probably the last 100 years or so, but it seems like that is accelerating quite a bit within the last couple of decades. And on the surface, that sounds like a really great thing that people are living longer, and it should be. You know, we should live in a society where living long is a great thing, but it is really beginning to change some of the models and some of the thinking around how we price things. You know, how much longer are people going to live going forward? If these advancements in science continue to make us live longer, what does that mean? For people, for the life insurance industry, it's a great thing. If people are living longer, they're not going to pay claims until longer. However, it's a different dilemma for people, for the annuity industry, paying out annuities for people who, you know, until the end of their life. It's a different thing for people in the health industry where, you know, we have to think about, again, on the surface, it sounds like it's great that people are living, but is that also resulting in morbidity, what we call morbidity compression? Are people living healthier when they're living longer, or are they getting sicker at the same time and living sicker for longer? So these are things as actuaries we're really trying to struggle. We're struggling with, you know, what does this all mean? And it has different pushes and pulls in the different insurance industries. And I think for society as well, you know, if we're living longer, is the labor pool going to be big enough to provide the services for the people who can't provide them for themselves today? These all work their ways into not only the actuarial factors, but economic factors and demographic factors and cultural factors that we all have to struggle with. And so actuaries, you know, we have to model these things out so that we as a society can react to and plan for them. Used to be, for example, you retired at age 65 and your lifespan might have been another, you know, 6 to 7 years. It's not like that anymore. I mean, people live, you know, over 20 years past when they retire. So it just changes what you do before retirement. So I think, again, as a society, we have to think about how this longevity trend is going to affect us and how we ought to change our behavior to meet our needs in a society where we're living longer.
I think this just opens up Pandora's box for discussion. For instance, we read statistically, recently at least, that the lifespan of the typical female who changes to a vegetarian diet can extend 7 years on average, and then for the typical male, almost 10 years, simply by making that one subtle change in diet. I'm sure that that would be an important part of these actuarial models. And then, of course, we also know that probably teetotalers and non-smokers in particular, things of that nature, would seem to be critical, particularly, as you mentioned, in the health areas, as well as the annuities, which continue to pay typically until the end of the lifespan. Any comments?
Well, yeah, and it's, all these things you're talking about are new predictors that, again, actuaries need to be aware of and look for as we are developing our predictions. So if diet has an effect, then that needs to be pulled into the things that we're considering when we create our models.
You were speaking earlier of the demographics, which is just key and integral, I think, to formulating sufficient models for these forecasts that you've alluded to. There's also been, I think, a little bit of blowback, you might agree, that perhaps we're not comfortable in some factions of society with how that data has come into play and whether or not there shouldn't be some oversight. Any comment?
Yeah, I agree with both. I agree that data is very important and that it needs oversight. And so, but I think our society needs to understand that, you know, the more information that can be gathered about them, their lives, it can make their lives a lot easier. Like, for example, I don't know if you're familiar with the iPhone app Waze. That's an application. It used to be people didn't want anybody knowing where they were driving, how fast they were going, any of that. But now there's an app where you can sign on and you share all that information anonymously with everybody else who's driving. And it's great because now we're sharing information about where traffic is, how fast it's flowing, where there's hazards on the road. And this information makes your life easier because now you can navigate around all that. And I think people are willing to give that information because what is given back to them is something that's useful that they can apply in their lives in that moment. And I think as a society, we need to get to a point where, because I think just ultimately, you know, the more information we can share about ourselves, again, it can be anonymously. I think that's really the trick. The more we can learn about ourselves so that we can use it and implement it in our lives. Again, I think the Waze app can be, this isn't a commercial for Waze, but that's a great example of if there's some way that we can give more data to people that can do something with it, give us back something that we can use, I think your society will very much benefit from it. Like, for example, if you could collect information about what everybody's eating, and that turns out that, you know, the people that are eating this certain thing more are living longer or are healthier, and that information can be tabulated, summarized, and get back out to people in a trustful way. Well, you can make a behavior correction right then and there. Again, just like knowing where the traffic is and getting around it. Again, I just think knowing things that you can change in your daily life to make yourself healthier, get into accidents less frequently, live longer, I think that's all information that would be helpful for society, not just insurance companies.
Many free apps out there now monitor, for instance, pedometers and things of that nature through your iPhone, if you will, or other PDAs, and monitor, you know, your heart rate. Not terribly expensive, but I'm starting to hear just among, you know, my small circle of friends how this is becoming an everyday occurrence. So that's really just listed for our listeners. Maybe I haven't mentioned this on the show. We try to keep health as at least an undercurrent here, a theme on the broadcast. Chief Bodner, what a pleasure it's been to have you here on the show today. And I wonder if there's any information that you'd like to share about your institution. Are there any parting comments, sir?
Yes, I just would like to play a little bit of a commercial for the actuarial field itself. For those of you, you know, in the audience that have an inclination towards mathematics, this has got to be the best kept secret for mathematicians. Most people don't know about the field. It's a great field. We cannot attract enough people into it. on an annual basis. There's more of a demand for what we do than there is a supply for people that are willing to be actuaries. It's a great career. It pays well. It's not ranked the number one field for no reason. There's a good reason for it. So I would encourage anybody in the audience that thinks that they may be inclined to be an actuary to take a look at the field. Just Google, what does it take to be an actuary or what is an actuary? You'll get lots of information. I would encourage you to look into the field because we need you.
I'm on board with you, and I'll give a little promo here as well from my local alma mater. Clemson University has a really fantastic program, mathematics program, and they're offering Math 4300, which I sat through for Exam P, and we also have a great program for Exam FM, which is typically the follow-up to Exam P. And if your child or even you love mathematics and excel with standardized tests, and you want to follow a fascinating track where you'll be taking exams over a period of, let's say, 5 to 10 years, depending on your proficiency, you could become an actuarial fellow. It's just a remarkable profession. Chief Bobner, what a pleasure again to have you here today. Thanks for taking time from your busy schedule. It's very gracious of you, and we wish you the best, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with CunkerChange.com. Score one for the Fed this week, as they clearly won the game of psychological warfare against learned people who should know better about whether or not interest rates were going to be raised. They were not going to be raised, despite all the hoopla and expectation mumbo-jumbo bandied about on every single media outlet that exists. And for the record, there was never any intention of raising interest rates, nor will there be at the next Fed meeting, or the one after that, or the one after that, ad infinitum, for some time to come. Everyone wants to believe the same tired, worn-out story, namely that we're almost there with the economic recovery, so much so that expectations create the psychological setup implying to just about everyone that the Fed will raise interest rates because the economy is supposedly so healthy. But then in the final hour, just to be safe, the Fed splits the difference and postpones any rate hike until most likely the next Fed meeting, when it will most certainly raise rates because the economy is so healthy and almost there. Well, the distance between where we're at and almost there isn't small. It's more like the distance between Earth and NASA's newly discovered Earth 2.0. It's a long way, and a distance we're not likely to traverse in our lifetimes. Interest rates aren't going up anytime soon, outside of a token symbolic gesture. They cannot, or they will destroy what remains of a global financial system financed on short-term debt, subject to interest rate volatility. But a lot of people who know that, or should know that, forget that, as they did this past week. I paid no attention to the Fed's mutterings or other talking head preambles, suggesting this could be the week, and what that would mean if rates were raised. I only tuned in to confirm that rates were not raised. But I was a bit taken aback by people I know and respect who were actually being misdirected by the Fed playbook which should be transparent to anyone who has been following it since the 2008 crisis began. Instead of the boy who cried wolf, Janet Yellen has become the girl who cries wolf regarding the likelihood of expected future rate hikes. Since rates didn't rise this week, Fed policymakers are implying rates will rise by the end of the year or in early 2016. Unlike the children's fable, where the villagers eventually became wise to false cries of a wolf attacking the sheep, the public at large, and most alarmingly, the financial media, seem focused on entertaining the bogus rate hike expectations of the Fed, creating the illusion of interest rate hikes are imminently within reach, when in fact they are nowhere within sight, now or in the foreseeable future. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.